proudly supporting WHYY, is New Jersey's Clean Energy Program, educating businesses, local governments, schools, and residents how to integrate energy-efficient and renewable technologies into their new construction projects, existing building upgrades, and new equipment installation. More information about modernizing facilities with assistance from New Jersey's Clean Energy Program at njcleanenergy.com/WHYY.
Pennsylvania drivers have a new way to get a heads up about roadway construction projects. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. First, the Philadelphia chapter of the National Organization for Women wants Philadelphia District Attorney Seth Williams to do something about the revelation the two senior prosecutors in his office traded pornographic email on state computers. Philadelphia Now President Nina Ahmed says they should know digital porn in the office is harmful and degrading to women.
You really don't want your chief law enforcement entities to also be engaging in this behavior, especially when they're people we count on to end violence against women.
The revelations came in court filings unsealed last Wednesday. Williams says he's reviewing the matter. The Pennsylvania Department of Transportation is rolling out an interactive map designed to give residents a better handle on the delays they might encounter along the road. WHYY's Todd Bookman reports.
If you struggle to keep track of Pennsylvania's 985 or so active construction projects, you can finally rest easy. The new projects.penndot.gov website lets you virtually travel the state, getting information on everything from repaving to bridge replacement jobs. Erin Waters-Trasat is PennDOT's spokesperson.
If you're traveling through the state, let's say for the upcoming Labor Day holiday, you can say, well, let's see what construction is going to be on Interstate 81 or I-95, and you can look for that entire corridor without checking a few different locations.
The map also includes all scheduled projects through 2026. Along with the roads involved, the site also lists cost and estimated completion date for each job. Janet Tidwell from AAA says her group applauds the effort.
It is so important for taxpayers to be able to see where their dollars are being spent. And this is definitely as transparent as you can get.
Transparent and also fairly simple to use, according to Dawn McDougall. She's with the civic hacking group Code for Philly.
They're interested in using this as a way of demonstrating what they're doing, sort of like here are your tax dollars at work signs. This is sort of that on a larger scale.
One drawback to the site, however, is that it doesn't combine its map with real-time traffic reports to alert you how much construction will slow you down. PennDOT says it may look to integrate that feature down the road. For WHYY News, I'm Todd Bookman.
New Jersey Watchdog has previously focused its light on the process of double-dipping by New Jersey state legislators, administration officials, school superintendents, state police, and the staffs of the attorney general and county prosecutors. More recently, though, looking at that same practice by New Jersey sheriffs. And with that story, joining me is New Jersey Watchdog's Mark Lagerquist. Mark, thanks for joining us again on NewsWorks Tonight.
Always a pleasure, Dave.
Tell us more about this practice.
Under a pension loophole, what a number of New Jersey officials are allowed to do is they're allowed to retire, start collecting a public pension, but continue working as a public employee. So they become double dippers, getting paid both retirement plus paychecks as active workers.
Perfectly legal.
It's legal, but it's a loophole. And one way to really look at the loophole is we focused on the sheriff of Essex County, who 25 years ago today, he retired. He's been retired for 25 years, but he never left his job. He's been continuing to work for the last 25 years while getting a paycheck, and now it's a six-figure paycheck. And during that period of time, he's collected, I believe, $1.35 million in retirement benefits, but he never retired.
He has the same job description now as he did 25-plus years ago?
Well, what happened is 25-plus years ago, he retired as county undersheriff. Then the following Monday, after he retired on a Friday, he went back to work. Same salary, same duties, but a different job title, sheriff's officer chief. And then 1 year after that, he became sheriff, and he's held that job ever since.
So this might be the most egregious, but certainly not the only example you found.
No, because what we found is we found that three-fourths of New Jersey's county sheriffs are essentially doing the same thing. They retired as law enforcement officers. They get a pension, and now they're back to work as sheriffs. And not only that, these 16 sheriffs also employ 37 undersheriffs who are doing the same exact thing. So what you have is you have a giant loophole here that some legislators have recognized, but they've been unable to close it because this is so lucrative to so many people who are in high positions.
When you add it all up, how much is it costing the taxpayer?
Well, at least in terms of the sheriffs and the undersheriffs, they're collecting $10 million a year from public coffers, $5.7 million in salaries, and then the rest in retirement pay. And that's quite a bit of money.
Mark, to the extent that these are elected positions, do you think this will have some impact on the next election, or is this not widely known yet?
It's not that widely known. The people who know about it, this is something that people actually get emotionally charged about, particularly as taxes go up and the pension system is getting deeper and deeper in trouble and they're not fixing the pension system. Governor Christie's own Blue Ribbon panel that looked at this, what they said verbatim is the double dippers have become the face of a dysfunctional public pension system. So, I mean, this is sort of the egregious part of it.
And apparently even the aforementioned sheriff of Essex County admits that it doesn't look good.
Yeah, in an interview he said, no, this doesn't look good. He admits it, but it's legal, so he does it.
Thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Always a pleasure, Dave.
That's New Jersey Watchdog's Mark Lagerquist. Pope Francis will conclude his visit to Philadelphia next month with a huge outdoor mass. As many as 2 million attendees are expected to cram onto the Ben Franklin Parkway to worship with His Holiness. For Catholics, the climax of the mass is a special meal known as Holy Communion. And that got WHYY's Katie Culinary wondering, how will the Pope feed so many people?
In the Bible, Jesus famously feeds a crowd of 5,000 people with just 5 loaves of bread and 2 small fish. Pope Francis will have an even larger flock to feed when he celebrates Mass in Philadelphia next month, but he'll have lots of help. Father Dennis Gill is in charge of figuring out how it's all going to work. We meet in the sacristy at the Basilica of Saints Peter and Paul in Center City, where Father Gill is rector. It's the place where he gets ready for Mass several times a week.
This is the workroom, if you will, for the liturgies.
A rather formal and soft-spoken man, Gill is also the head of divine worship for the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. Having lived in Vatican City for 10 years, he's got a lot of experience participating in many papal masses with John Paul II and Benedict XVI.
Sometimes they're incredibly wonderful experiences, a sense of Christ and his church assembled from all over the world. Sometimes, because of other features, they weren't so wonderful. Sometimes people don't behave in a large crowd.
Gill has faith this Mass will go smoothly. By the numbers, it'll involve 1,500 priests and deacons who will help distribute about 500,000 communion wafers consecrated by Pope Francis. Ushers will carry gold and white umbrellas to protect the wafers, or hosts, and to mark the spots where they'll be distributed. While many Christians celebrate communion, Catholics believe that the bread and wine literally transform into the body and blood of Jesus. That's why it's so important to Father Gill to keep the mood reverent, even with a crowd of more than 1 million. So only wafers will be given out, and 100,000 of them were made here, in the kitchen at the Monastery of St. Clair in Langhorne, Bucks County. This is where a small group of cloistered nuns, known as the Poor Clares, bake altar breads just as they have done for almost 100 years. First, the sisters mix a simple batter of flour and water. Then, they ladle the batter onto hot stoves to bake. A top plate with designs like crosses and other religious symbols is lowered down to make patterns in the giant wafers as they cook. Later, the sisters cut the thin sheets of bread into circles and pack them up to be shipped to churches in this area and as far away as Canada. Baking altar breads is the work that breaks up days focused primarily on prayer, says Sister Anne, who's lived in this monastery for 17 years. Normally, the sisters make about 7,000 wafers a day, but for Pope Francis, they had to work even harder.
When we found out we might be making them, we stepped up our production a little, and we were making around 10,000 a day. So it's about 10 days worth of work.
Sister Anne takes me into a cool alcove where 10 large boxes full of wafers for the papal mass are ready for pickup. The sisters rarely leave the monastery except for doctor's appointments, but the Archdiocese of Philadelphia has given these women permission to attend the mass, although some of them have opted to stay behind and watch it on TV. Whether they stay or go, Sister Anne says baking the wafers is the most meaningful way for them to be part of the celebration.
It's a way that means a great deal to us because the breads become the communion host, become the body of Christ. And it's a way that we can be united with all the people there in a very hidden way, which is very much like our life.
On the day of the big mass, once Pope Francis blesses all those wafers, Father Dan Swift is hoping to help distribute them to the faithful. Swift is the pastor of St. Mary of the Lakes in Medford, New Jersey. He was in the Vatican 12 years ago when Mother Teresa was beatified, a step on the path to sainthood. He remembers being surrounded by hundreds of people who were clamoring to take communion but couldn't reach the priest.
I reached over the people in front of me and I pointed to my collar and I said to the priest, I said, give me some hosts. And I was able to break those hosts into the greatest number of particles, and people were receiving just, you know, maybe a crumb, if you will. But whether it's a whole host, a half a host, or a crumb, Jesus is Jesus.
The Archdiocese expects the 500,000 wafers it's ordered will be enough for all of the Catholics in the crowd, even though more than 1 million people are expected to attend. But if they do run out of wafers, perhaps they'll follow Father Swift's lead and continue breaking the bread. Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
As our entire region prepares to show off Philadelphia for the Pope and all those visitors, we're called to reflect on the city we live in. What's your prayer for the city? We're collecting them on our website. You can share yours and see what others have to say at whyy.org/popeinphilly. Turning to this evening's headlines, utility regulators in Delaware and Maryland have filed a complaint with federal officials. They're challenging how much their state's energy customers will have to pay for a regional project involving a New Jersey nuclear power plant. The project aims to improve system stability at the nuclear power units on Artificial Island by building a transmission line to a new Delaware substation. The proposal calls for Delmarva Electric customers, including all customers in Delaware, to pay about 90% of the $275 million project, even though officials say it would benefit states throughout the region. New Jersey's Stockton University says it's weighing several expressions of interest in the former Showboat Casino property that it now owns. The school bought the shuttered casino last December, hoping to turn it into a satellite campus, but competing legal claims and use restrictions have prevented them from doing so. Stockton still hopes to open a satellite campus elsewhere in Atlantic City. Partly cloudy, 88 degrees on Independence Mall, it's 619. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Anticipate clearing skies overnight, falling back to 72 degrees, and then hazy, hot, and humid days tomorrow and Wednesday and Thursday, high each day in the low 90s. Ahead to Friday, partly sunny, there is a 30% chance of late-day showers, maybe even a thunderstorm. Friday's high, 88. Still ahead, astronomers are looking for a few good names for hundreds of celestial bodies.
What has now come to pass is the opportunity for the general public to vote on a selection of name possibilities for each of the extrasolar planets orbiting the chosen stars.
Newsworks Tonight looks aloft on WHYY.
The moment Ernie Isley dialed in his guitar tone for that lady, the Isley brothers knew they had something special.
And I asked for a phase shifter. And when I got it and plugged in and hit the very first note of the lead solo, it was like, wow, where are we?
Ernie Isley reflects on six decades of the Isley Brothers, later on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Carol Hills. Too much CO2 in the atmosphere. That's the basic problem of climate change. So what if we could make something that could suck CO2 out of the air, like a tree?
Our goal is to build devices just like a tree. They stand passively, and as the air blows over it, they absorb the CO2 out of it.
The quest to build the artificial tree, next time on The World.
tonight at 8 on WHYY.
When you're in a band and you go on tour, do you go where the diehard fans are, or do you go where the money is?
On U2's last tour, they played Los Angeles, but they didn't even stop in San Diego. They went straight to Phoenix. Sometimes we're just a second thought.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Don't take it personally, man. It's not about you. The story next time on Marketplace from APM.
Coming up next on WHYY.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. What's in a name? How about 20 names? Let's play the planetary name game with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, there's nothing wrong with PSRB 1257 plus 12, but what do the parents of these 20 have in mind?
Well, you know, that's quite a mouthful if you want to go by that kind of designation for a planet. Why not have something simpler like Mars or...
Dave,
we can do that. We can do Dave. So the International Astronomical Union has opened up the opportunity for the general public to help in this process. And so the International Astronomical Union first identified about a year and a half ago a little over 300 objects that could be selected as candidates to be given the first set of names. So that opportunity was first presented to informal science institutions and astronomy clubs, if you will, to suggest names for the 20 most likely objects to be named as planets. So as we look at the process, what has now come to pass is the opportunity for the general public to vote on a selection of name possibilities for each of the extrasolar planets orbiting the chosen stars.
How long does the voting go?
Well, the voting goes until October 31st, right up until Halloween. And between now and then, you can actually go to the website nameexoworlds.iau.org/exoworldvote. And you can actually look at the objects, learn some about them, their various characteristics and parameters of size, orbit, and then look at the list of names that have been offered, choose the one you like, and your vote can actually tally up with all of the other folks that are vying for a chance to help name a planet.
And will this be as official as Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, etc., or could it be subject to subsequent name change?
Well, actually, it's looking like these will be the actual names for the planets. In fact, if we think about the number of possibilities for exoplanets turning up that will need names, we're going to need lots and lots and lots more people voting on this to be able to narrow down to one name.
Back to Venus and Mars. They're among the cohort available to be seen in the night sky this week.
And thank goodness they've already been named, and we've known them for some time. Yes, Venus and Mars are now appearing together this week in the pre-dawn sky between 5:30 and 6:15 a.m. They are low in the east, but Venus is brilliant, and Mars is off to the left of Venus, and you can easily identify the two without too much difficulty at all. Jupiter is also there, but very, very close to the horizon at that time, and will be difficult to see. However, as we move on into the fall, all three of them will rise up out of the sunrise, if you will, and we'll be able to see them in ever-darkening skies as they rise earlier and earlier and earlier.
And as they're rising up, asteroids are raining down.
Yes, scientists have found evidence that asteroids and other pieces of space debris are falling into our atmosphere all the time. Now, we may not be aware of it because these pieces are so small, but every once in a while, one of these asteroids does stand out because of its size. Just a couple of years ago, an asteroid about 60 feet in size came very far down into the Earth's atmosphere and exploded about 20 miles above the surface of the Earth. Now, that explosion over central Russia caused a tremendous shockwave over the city of Chelyabinsk, created a lot of damage, broke out a lot of windows. In fact, some people were actually injured because of this. But we don't see many of those these days anymore because most of them have been swept up by all of the planets of the solar system.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
You find Earth boring, just the same old, same thing. Come on, sign up with outer space, ways incorporated.
One of Philadelphia's most prominent artists passed away last week. Nelson Shanks, a highly sought-after portrait painter, was 77 when he died of cancer on Friday. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that his lasting legacy may be the art school that he founded.
Nelson Shanks painted the portraits of major political and cultural leaders around the world, including Pope John Paul II, President Ronald Reagan, President Bill Clinton, British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, Princess Diana, and opera tenor Luciano Pavarotti. These subjects sat for him, sometimes for as many as 40 hours. Afterward, many became lifelong friends. Shanks said so in this interview from 2013.
I sort of do connect with people on a pretty great level, a very deep level when they pose for me, because it's something about self-examination and I think the bonding that goes on between myself and sitters. I make a lot of lifetime friends, as a result of this procedure.
In 2002, Shanks and his wife founded a small art school, an atelier, in Philadelphia's North Chinatown. They called it Studio Incaminati. That's an Italian word for journey. One of the founding board members is Joseph Rischel. He's a senior curator at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. He says Shanks championed classical realism when many art schools were teaching expressive and abstract styles.
And I'll go to the students, and within a 45-minute sketch out the basics of a head. I mean, it's just wizardry. It's like pulling bunnies out of hats.
Almost immediately after founding the school, Nelson Shanks was diagnosed with cancer. His wife, Leona Shanks, says her husband made sure the school stayed focused on figurative realism.
I mean, my husband was diagnosed with cancer in 2003, and it went metastatic in 2009. So he and I have been, you know, we knew that this day was coming, so he always did everything in his power to prepare. And he wants Incaminati to last forever. I mean, every day, even for the last 2 months when he was so sick, there wasn't a single day where we didn't pour our hearts and minds over the future of the school.
Studio Incaminati continues to be run by its own board and president. Fall classes start this week. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Rising tuition costs, demands for improved student outcomes, competition from online schools. It's tough running a college these days. A new study asks presidents of colleges and universities about their views on the future of higher education in the United States. We'll get the view from the top from two leaders of local colleges on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.
Karen Treatment Center supports WHYY. Is someone you care about struggling, losing interest in activities they loved? Changes like these can be a sign of drug and alcohol abuse. As a behavioral health care and addiction treatment center, Karen helps families understand when professional help is warranted, offering therapies that restore wellness in body, mind, and spirit. A confidential assessment is available at 855-894-4325 or at karen.org. That's C-A-R-O-N.org.